Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The highest inflation in 40 years is affecting us all, some more than others. Rising fuel and also food prices in particular are a big problem for school districts across the country, especially those districts in rural areas. IPR's Kendall Crawford has visited three school districts in northwest Iowa, looked at how these small town districts are struggling. She joins me now. Hi, Kendall.
Hi, Ben.
Let's talk about the areas that I just mentioned, transportation and food, first of all. To transportation, help us understand the challenges for rural bus routes and the superintendents trying to balance the books here.
Yeah, you know, for rural schools, you know, transportation can look a little different just because, you know, students really rely on these buses, and they might be living, you know, 20, 30 miles away from the school that they're going to. They're in these remote locations, and they're waiting every day for that yellow bus to come. At Maple Valley Anthon Otto Community School District, which is one of the districts that I visited in Monona County, they have routes that stretch that far, 20 miles north, 10 miles southeast, and they've got 8 bus routes that are all going around each day. And, you know, what that all adds up to is a lot of diesel fuel. And, you know, when these prices are going up, they're at more than $5 a gallon. That means, you know, budgets are being tightened and stretched. At that school district specifically, they're about $16,000 over their average budget. And he told me, the superintendent, Jeff Thielander, told me that, you know, by the end of the year, he wouldn't be surprised if that number hits 20,000. So it's really stretching them thin. And that's because they do have these long routes. And it's not as easy as, you know, cutting one out, because students can only be on a bus for, you know, the legal limit is 55 minutes. If you take one bus route away, that might leave one of the students on the bus an hour, and you don't want to see that. So it's a really tough situation for these districts to be in, because they're kind of trying to navigate, how do we get all these students to school, but we don't want to, you know, overspend our transportation budget.
Right. And another major challenge here, you looked into food prices, of course, food being served at school. What's the story there?
Yeah. So food, you know, I think everybody has probably noticed at the grocery store some higher prices. And when you're buying things in bulk like this, you're definitely noticing that as well. You know, at the same district in Maple Valley, Anthon Otto, they mentioned, you know, ham is something that they have at their salad bar every day. The kids love the salad bar, but that's up $8 a pound. You know, lettuce too is up at $7 a case. And, you know, Iowans love their ranch dressing. And, you know, that's been surging at little over $5 a case as well. And when you add that up for that school district in particular, it looks like $500 more each week for students. And when you break that down, it's about $1.36 for per student per day. And that's a big cost. And I think, you know, the tension there with food costs is they don't want to, you know, raise the cost of their school lunches for these families that are also facing inflation, that are also, you know, struggling to get food at the grocery store. But they are seeing a significant increase. And so they're talking about, well, can we raise it by, you know, 10 cents and still, you know, make it affordable for students? You know, next year is actually when, you know, not every student is going to get free lunch, which is something, you know, that happened with COVID. They had these benefits, and they're losing some of that next year, next school year. So, you know, you add inflation with losing some of those benefits, and it kind of puts these districts with this question, well, how do we get students fed without blowing our food budgets as well? It's just another area that is really seeing an increase for districts.
Yeah. So when you went through transportation, rising costs there, food you just described, when you talked with these and visited these school districts, their superintendents, and when cuts need to be made, how are you finding these superintendents making the decision of where to cut? What are they considering?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. And I think the refrain I heard from a lot of districts is we want to make these cuts as far from the classroom as we can. And luckily, you know, a lot of the districts that I spoke to, Westwood Community School District in Sloan, Iowa, they mentioned, you know, they're in good shape right now. They have been, you know, scrimping, they've been saving for the past 8 years or so. And so they have, you know, some reserve funds that they can go through. But it's just that inflation is really eating up these buffers, these reserve funds. And it's kind of looking in the future when you're setting your budget. Well, if this inflation continues and these costs are still going to be up, what can we cut? And I think they don't want to see staffing or programming go. But if you're a school district and, you know, staffing makes up around 80% of your budget, that's something you have to think about. You have to think about, well, do we have a position we could maybe cut here to try to get those funds back?
Yeah. And it's interesting in your piece, maybe you can remind us now, as you did in your piece, the how school districts are funded by the state and how that fits into the current problem, especially when we consider rural school districts facing declining enrollment.
Yeah. So when we think about school districts, a lot of the funding is coming from the state, and it's this per pupil state funding. So that basically just means, you know, the number of students is kind of dictating how much that you're getting from the state legislature. And when you add declining enrollment on top of that for these schools, rural schools more often than not are seeing kind of this decrease in enrollment over the years. They're seeing smaller class sizes, but that doesn't mean it's all coming in the same place. It doesn't mean, you know, you're just seeing a decrease in, say, your fourth grade class, so you could cut a fourth grade teacher. It's kind of without the whole system. So you're seeing this slow trickle of students that are not in the classrooms, and you're trying to figure out, well, do we cut the fourth grade teacher, or those class sizes going to be too big then at that grade? Or, you know, looking and trying to do the math, I mean, you still have a lot of the same operating costs, even when you have declining enrollment. So the lights still have to be on, the buses still have to be running, but, you know, you're just seeing a couple of students less. And, you know, a lot of money is tied to one student. So you just see one student next year. And again, it's doing that math. Like, well, what are we losing with that student? What do we need to kind of reconsider and rethink?
Mm-hmm. And back to staffing and the 80% approximately of the district's funding going toward staffing. Rural districts have always had this problem, now perhaps even stressed more. They want to give the same quality education in rural areas as you do in the urban areas. And that's really a problem, isn't it? When you consider that they have to compete with, in this labor market, which is has a labor shortage.
Yeah, it's a huge thing that was mentioned. I think at rural school districts, they're all kind of already struggling with this issue of, you know, how can we recruit teachers? How can we get, you know, bus drivers? How can we get substitute teachers? And when you add inflation on top of that, you add these budgets being tightened and stretched. It just makes it all the more harder to make your wages competitive with other places. I mean, Superintendent Jay Lutt at Westwood Community School District in Sloan, he mentioned that, you know, on his drive to work, he sees the signs for Wendy's, he sees the signs for Hobby Lobby, and he looks at their starting hours, and it makes it harder.
They're starting pay per hour.
Yeah, starting pay per hour. And it just kind of makes it a little difficult when he thinks about what their school district is starting with and how he can compete with that. And I went to one of their school board meetings where they're setting the budget, and they talked a lot about raising these wages. They raised it the most than they have, I think he said, in the last 10 years by $2 an hour. But he still thinks that it's going to be hard to compete with other places and to find, you know, someone to drive the bus or someone to work at maintenance at the school. And then you add the teacher shortage on top of that, and it just looks like a bigger problem of recruiting and retaining these positions. A lot of people want to go maybe to the more urban area and are drawn in by that, but rural schools are kind of having to play to their strengths and look to see what they can advocate. But if your wages aren't matching there, that's really difficult.
So many challenges facing school districts, especially rural school districts in Iowa and across the country. Kendall Crawford visited three Northwest Iowa school districts to report. You can find her feature, her writing, at iowapublicradio.org. Kendall Crawford covers Western Iowa for IPR. Thank you so much, Kendall.
Thank you, Ben.
It's your News Buzz edition of River to River, a bit early this week on a Thursday, as I have tomorrow, Friday, off. Your News Buzz edition, quick conversations to end this week. Erin Jordan is an investigative reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. We talk to her often on this program. We love to do that. Let's check in with her now about a couple of interesting stories she's dug into and reported on. Hello, Erin.
Hello, Ben.
Let's talk about a piece that you had come out just this week. First of all, an interesting story of one homeowner in Cedar Rapids who is amazingly still struggling with the aftermath of the August 2020 derecho wind storm that caused so much damage. Of course, the most damage up in the Cedar Rapids Marion area. And I understand that this Cedar Rapids homeowner faces a lawsuit even though she paid a contractor for the derecho repairs she had done on her house. Tell us the story of Susan Moore of Cedar Rapids.
Yeah, well, Susan, like a lot of people, was at work when the derecho hit early afternoon on August 10th, 2020. And when she finally was able to get back to her house in Cedar Rapids, you know, lots of downed trees and things like that, you know, she saw there was a ton of damage to her roof. She had shingles all over the neighborhood. Her siding was kind of pockmarked by rocks and debris that had blown into it. So, you know, she needed to get repairs to her house. You know, a lot of the local roofing companies were backlogged. And so she connected with a roofing company that's actually based in Texas, but had set up in the Quad Cities after the derecho. And, you know, she was working with them to get some work done, and she got a payment from her insurance. But when she went to make the payment, the local project manager who lived in Cedar Rapids said, "Why don't you write that check to me and I'll get it to Regions Roofing, the larger company." Mm-hmm. And she did. He issued her a receipt for that. You know, the check was cashed. But then Regions Roofing says, "We never got that $22,000. And then they sued her in October 2021.
Okay, so to get this straight, there's this company. We had a lot of outside companies come to the state after that massive windstorm to repair damage. Our local resources really weren't adequate. Some people still repairing their homes from that that derecho windstorm. So the Texas-based company has people here, Regents Roofing of Texas. They have someone working for them who, this Vance is the name of this man. And he says, "Well, pay me and not directly the company." Am I getting that right?
Right, right. Yeah, Ray Vance was a project manager for Regions. You know, he had a business card that, you know, had his name on it, you know, and the Regions Roofing logo. You know, he appeared official, and you know, I think he was official. Regions had employed him in that function, but it was just when Susan wrote that check to him, somehow that money didn't get to the larger company.
Mm-hmm. And what happened after that?
So, like I said, Regan sued Moore, along with a couple other Cedar Rapids residents who also had roofing repairs after the derecho. And, you know, she tried to show them the documentation of the cash check, of the receipt written by Ray Vance, and the lawsuit still is proceeding. And I think what Susan is worried about is if it goes until December, when it's scheduled for a trial, that she's going to be paying more in legal fees than actually this lawsuit deals with, which is just under $30,000.
Mm-hmm. So the question also, where is that $22,000 written in a check to the project manager?
Yeah, and that's an interesting question, because Ray Vance now has died. So, you know, Vance died in March. So, you know, his family, who I reached out to, they live in other parts of the country. They hadn't heard anything about this. They were very surprised about this lawsuit, because Susan Moore has now filed a counterclaim against Vance and his company, Go Vance Development, because she says that's where she paid the money. So, you know, we may never know the answer of where that money went.
Wow, what a nightmare. After trying to get your home repaired from what it was, a weather nightmare, what sense did you get of how this has affected Susan Moore's life, her well-being? I have to, if it were me, many sleepless nights.
Yeah, I think she's had a lot of anxiety over it. She doesn't know what more she needs to do in order to prove that she did pay this money. It seems like she's looking for all sorts of documentation to provide as part of the lawsuit. She's also watching those legal bills mount the longer this goes on. And perhaps just hoping that Regions offers some sort of a settlement.
Yeah. Any takeaways, lessons you draw from reporting on this story?
Well, one thing, after the derecho, I did a story talking about how some of these outside companies were needed, because, as you said, there just wasn't enough capacity from Iowa-based roofing companies and siding companies. But I think what the takeaway is if you're not going to use a local company, you really need to research the out-of-state firm that you're using. You know, look for, you know, complaints that maybe were filed with the Better Business Bureau, the Iowa Attorney General's office. Also, their Office of Consumer Complaints has information, you know, about past complaints filed about companies that operate in the state. That may be a place to check. I think there's a lot of places you can look for reputable companies and just try to do your research.
Mm-hmm. Erin, before you go, I wanted to ask you about another story that's been out for some days that you put out in the Gazette as well. We mention often on this program, and Iowa, of course, the number one pork producing state in the nation. I always like to bring this statistic up, about 25 million hogs in the state at any one time. That means for you, me, for each one of us here in Iowa, there are about 8 hogs per person in the state. You also, though, recently reported on the long-term trend of Iowa producing more and more hogs in recent decades, but interestingly, at the same time, reducing the number of hog farmers in the state and the implications of that. Tell us more about what you looked at.
That's right. You know, these numbers are from the U.S. Census of Agriculture, which show that the number of Iowa farms with hogs fell 86% from 1982 to 2017. But during that same time period, the number of hogs in Iowa more than tripled. So, you know, those are, you know, kind of startling numbers if you think about that. But what it means is they're just a lot more concentrated. We have a lot more confined animal feeding operations than we had before. You know, maybe in the 80s, you still would have had people who had small amount of hogs on their farm, maybe along with cattle and other commodities. But that business model has really changed.
Right. And yeah, we don't typically see them even driving around. You see the large confinement facilities. But to think that there are 7 or 8 times the number of hogs as people in Iowa doesn't register, because we just see buildings unless we work in the industry. So you brought out some differing perspectives on how this has impacted our rural counties, the economies, jobs, populations. What were you interested in there?
Right. Well, Food and Water Watch, which is a Washington, D.C. based group that also has a lot of workers and members in Iowa, they support a moratorium on new large animal feeding operations. They released a report last week that kind of talks about how this increase in the number of hogs in Iowa and the concentration of those operations, they believe it's reduced farmers' profits and caused people to kind of migrate out of rural Iowa counties. You know, they use this data from the agricultural censuses to kind of make those points. I think that those things are, you know, that we have seen a migration of people from rural counties in Iowa to more metro areas. Although, you know, it's not necessarily clear how much of that is correlated with the increase in concentrated animal feeding operations.
Yeah. What has been specifically the environmental impact as far as you can tell?
Well, this report by Food and Water Watch doesn't get into the details of the environmental impact in a great way, but we've reported on other research that shows in some parts of the state, such as Northwest Iowa, where there's a higher concentration of those animal feeding operations, you have seen increased levels of nitrate in rivers and streams in those watersheds. So that's a specific environmental impact. You know, there's anecdotal evidence that people don't necessarily like living near these feeding operations, sometimes because of the smell. But I don't know that that has been quantified, at least in this research.
Yeah. And so it has an impact on jobs. And also the economics you explain in your article is fascinating, because the position this puts a small hog farmer in is really unsustainable, making just a few dollars per hog, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the study talks about how farmers earn $2 less per pound for hogs they produced in 2007 compared to 1982. And I think there's probably some different reasons for that. One just being that efficiency of operations means that, you know, you're getting less per pound, but you have more hogs. So, you know, you're still making more money. But there's just not as many small operators. Unless they have a real specialty type of hog, you're probably not going to see that much.
Okay. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Erin Jordan, investigative reporter for The Gazette. We look forward to your further reporting. Erin, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, hey, we just noticed it's suddenly summer, right? coming up after a short break, I'll talk with a meteorologist at the National Weather Service of Des Moines, Mike Fowle. We'll talk about the big shift we experienced this week. Went from cold and rainy to hot and humid. And of course, that raises some familiar concerns about drought. We'll talk about it when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com. Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A member of a school board in eastern Iowa facing some scrutiny regarding a private meeting with Governor Kim Reynolds, also with U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson. Let's learn more about this news, about a meeting about the district's new transgender policy. Grace King has been reporting on it. She covers K-12 education for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Hi, Grace.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Nice to have you on to talk about this. Of course, transgender policies and news, a big part of our news as it is across the country. Let's back up to first have you tell us about the Linmar School District's new transgender policy and when that was voted on and implemented last month, right?
Yes. So the district introduced these two policies last month that spell out inclusive practices for transgender students, including giving students access to the restroom that they prefer, locker rooms, changing areas that correspond with their gender identity, and protect students' privacy by keeping their transgender status private at school if they wish to. This required two votes from the school board to pass, and it was passed 5-2 in both votes with school board members Matt Rollinger and Barry Buchholz opposing it.
Okay, and as you mentioned in your article, the policies voted, approved by Linmar School District align with the Iowa Department of Education's guidance on equality for transgender students. Okay, so tell us about the discussion before this 5-2 vote, these votes that introduced this new policy. What was it like?
There was a school board meeting on April 25th. This was the second board meeting to approve the policies to put them into practice in the district. With 4 hours of public comment, 76 speakers opposed the policies and calling them woke and unchristian. There's just a lot of fear of the unknown of students who are transgender using the bathroom that corresponds with their gender identity, and people are uncomfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now to the meeting last week. This is the one that you focus on in this piece, the meeting between one of the school board members and Governor Reynolds and Ashley Hinson, Congresswoman Hinson.
Yes, so the media didn't find out about this meeting until after the fact. Neither did the other Linmar school board members, except for Matt Rollinger. It sounds like he received an email to his personal email account, not his school account, inviting him to a private meeting with Governor Reynolds and Ashley Hinson. That invitation was later put on social media by someone and started getting a lot of shares, a lot of interest. So they just decided to let anyone who came to come in to the meeting and you know, have this discussion with them.
Yeah, and for those who aren't acquainted with school board meetings and how you represent yourself as a school board member, what's wrong with that? What concerns did it raise?
Well, school board members were really concerned that Matt didn't share this information with them. They said it goes against their school board policies, especially that he didn't tell, you know, even the superintendent about what was happening. While he said that he is not attending as a school board member, he later said that he went to hear from his constituents. So that indicates to me that he was still representing the school board when he was there.
Mm-hmm. And you have some quotes from other school board members. Barry Buchholz, he's quoted in your article. You say he supports Reynolds and Hinson, but the quote from him, but I can honestly say I was a little disappointed to see a private meeting held by invite only, another by the school board president, Britannia Mori. If you got an email inviting you to a meeting that specifically said it was in regard to the district and didn't tell any of us, that's the part that gets sketchy for me. So elaborate on that. What went on and what followed there? That the meeting did turn out to be a public meeting or somewhere in between private and public in the end because it was made known on social media?
It sounds like somewhere in between. As you know, this wasn't on Governor Reynolds' public agenda for the day. The media was not invited, and a governor spokesperson told the Gazette that the meeting was private, but it seems like any community members who showed up were welcome to come into the meeting.
So those who objected to this type of private meeting, what did they think was planned or going to go on?
The meeting was advertised, according to Rollinger, as a meeting about the Linmar School District. And while some have been reporting that it was also about school vouchers for private schools, it seemed like it was mostly about Linmar school community and those families' concerns. School board members said that this was a one-sided meeting. Only one side of this transgender student discussion was represented, the people against these policies. When there had been a more open meeting just the week before to hear both sides of this discussion with those 4 hours of public comment.
Mm-hmm. Can you see there any repercussions to this controversial meeting?
Yeah, as one of the school board members said, it kind of creates an echo chamber. It's the same people with the same concerns, and there's no learning from each other happening. It's just frustration and anger. And later that week, this meeting took place on a Wednesday, and that Friday, there was a protest against these transgender policies outside of Lynmar High School, which is hurtful to the transgender kids who go there and the people of the LGBTQ community.
Mm-hmm. Grace King, in covering this, I wonder, because the transgender policy, transgenderism, as we understand it, is fairly new to a lot of people in the state, parents in the state. You talked about fear of the unknown. Talk about that a little bit more. In talking with parents and others in this school district, is it really that you think that perhaps awareness needs to be raised about what it means to be transgender?
You know, for these transgender kids, this is not a choice. They were born feeling like they are not the biological gender they were born with. And it can be scary when people don't accept that, don't accept who they really are. Coming out, explaining to someone, hey, I feel this way. A lot of people are envisioning these disaster scenarios, you know, where someone is going to come into the restroom they don't belong in and possibly harm someone else. But that just isn't happening. Statistically, it's not happening in Iowa. It's not happening across the nation. In fact, policies like the ones Lynmar adopted protects transgender students by giving them the space that, you know, corresponds with their gender identity.
Grace, it's important to mention, as you did in your article, that the Iowa Department of Education's website has changed in terms of its wording about transgender students. What's happened there?
Last week, I received the policy shared with me by the Cedar Rapids Community School District, who follows this guidance. You know, students have a right to keep their transgender status private at school. School's anti-discrimination policies must include gender identity discrimination, and staff need to be trained about gender identity issues. These are all things that are similar to what Lynmar adopted in their policies. However, on Monday, I noticed that the Department of Education had taken this down from their website. It just says the content of this website is being reviewed for legal accuracy in light of recent court decisions. The Department of Education has not responded to let me know what recent court decisions they're referring to. They said the information was taken down several months ago for the department to review the guidance, since it hasn't been updated since 2017. So that's all I know at this point. I'll be watching that webpage to see if they put anything new up there and if they update their guidance on equity for transgender students.
Grace King, thanks for the update. Grace covers K-12 education for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Thank you so much, Grace.
Thank you for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Wow, suddenly summer. Almost in the blink of an eye, it seems, a big shift from cold and rainy, that was our April for the most part, to hot and humid summer-like weather. The calendar says May, but it feels like we fast-forwarded, well, at least a month. Let's find out what's happened and what's likely to happen from here on out. Mike Fowle is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Mike, so good to talk with you again.
Hello. Nice to chat with you as well.
What caused this sudden shift?
Well, yeah, we did. As you mentioned, we went kind of from a cool, rainy early spring to what we call instant summer around here sometimes. And yeah, we see that in Iowa occasionally. And basically what's occurred is we just had a big a pattern shift in the atmosphere. So we were getting essentially a lot of air masses that were originating from the north, from Canada. And now we've switched things around, and a lot of our air masses are coming from the south. So we've had a lot of south winds, and that's really warmed us up again very rapidly. And then the other thing is, it's just, you know, it's we are now the 12th of May. The daylight's getting longer, and that's kind of typical as well. So kind of the combination of those two things, right, really, really allowed us to kind of flip a switch here. And again, we see this from time to time, and this heat is going to continue, at least the real warm conditions, for at least another few days. And then we should kind of settle back into something a little closer to typical mid-May conditions.
Mm-hmm. Give us a picture from above of the U.S. and this new system that moved in. How big is this sprawling dome of summer-like heat?
Yeah, so basically, like it typically occurs, it's kind of a tale of two halves across the United States. It's been really cold, and there's actually been some snow across the western U.S., and then conversely here across really the eastern half or so of the United States, it's been really warm. And this expands, again, basically from the Plain States and the Dakotas, and then all the way at least into the Ohio River Valley. So with temperatures ranging well above normal. And we're kind of right in the heart of that warm air mass here across the upper Midwest, including the state of Iowa. So, yeah, temperatures around here averaging, you know, some 10 to 20 degrees above normal, and sometimes even higher than that. So, yeah, quite the pattern change.
And any records broken?
We have, yeah. We were close the past few days, and yesterday was the first day across at least our area. We did set some records. Mason City yesterday had a record high of 93 degrees. That smashed the old record of 88 back in 1922. And then in Ottumwa, Iowa, it was 91 yesterday. And again, that was a tie of the old record. So keep in mind, there's probably some other locations. These are, when we send out the records, they're for stations that have a much longer period of record. So those are pretty significant. And even across, again, eastern sections of Iowa, we're going to be at or near record highs again today, and as well as across central Iowa. We're going to be probably breaking some records again today as well. Right now, eastern Iowa also has a heat advisory out, and we think these are some of the earliest heat advisories that we've probably ever issued here, would be across, again, at least since about 2005 or so across Iowa. So again, pretty extraordinary early season warmth.
Mm-hmm. You said maybe by next week we'll be back to more typically spring weather for May. I'm wondering what this unusual system, I heard it or I read a little bit about it, called an omega block. I don't know if that's in everybody's lingo there where you work, this high pressure parked over the center of the country. What does that mean for spring as typically a time for severe weather? Will we still have the chances as we normally do for severe weather?
Yeah, the omega block is kind of interesting, right? We have a lot of patterns or a lot of terms that we use to describe weather patterns. And that's basically meaning, right, we have a low pressure center across the West Coast. We have a big ridge of high pressure across the central U.S. And then there's another trough of low pressure, again, further to the east near the mid-Atlantic area. And that's what we kind of, if you kind of were to draw that out, it kind of looks like an omega shape, like the Greek symbol. So yeah, that's what's causing all the warmth. And then when the omega block breaks down, that's typically, again, we'll get into a little more of a pattern change. But the one thing about that, so we're going to start to see that again occur as early as late today and especially tonight. We are expecting the trough of low pressure to move through, and we have a pretty good chance of getting some severe weather across portions of the upper Midwest, especially late this afternoon, but more likely early tonight. The highest risk is going to be just to the north of Iowa across portions of the Dakotas and Minnesota, but we have a pretty good chance of seeing some showers and thunderstorms here across Iowa. Best chance of severe would be across the western sections of the state. And again, that's typically what happens. So we're going to have an air mass change. It's getting high today, central portions of Iowa in the mid-90s. Tomorrow, a bit cooler, probably in the about 10 degrees cooler, I would say mid-80s, around 83 or so here in the Des Moines area. And then as we get into the weekend, again, settling back down into the lower 80s, and then by early next week, back into the mid-70s. mm-hmm. again, which is closer to our average highs for this time of the year.
Does this bit of a flip-flop in weather, this summer-like weather now, this pattern system, the Omega block, does that indicate anything or predict anything in terms of the potential for drought this year?
Yeah, so the Omega block is more of a short-term feature, and so that in terms of what's going to happen from here on out, not necessarily. Again, we this time of year, in the springtime, the atmosphere is what we call very dynamic, so it can change very quickly. Sometimes you can get these patterns locked in where they just don't move much, but right now, at least over the next couple of weeks, it looks like it's going to be kind of a fairly changeable pattern. So at this point, they're looking at like the extended outlook, as you were mentioning over the summertime. Right now, we are still forecasting an above normal chance of seeing warmer than normal conditions into the summertime. And there's a slight hint that maybe drier than normal. So that would be in that June, July, August period. But again, at this point, it's changeable. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily put a whole lot of faith into that forecast at this point. The great news, well, which is a mixed blessing, the good news is we've seen a lot more moisture across portions of the Midwest that had been experiencing drought. The negative to that is I know for some of the ag folks, it's been a little tougher getting into the fields and such, mm-hmm. But we'll hopefully see some drier weather here and let those folks get out and do their work here.
Mike Fowle, so good to talk with you again of the National Weather Service in Des Moines. You take care. We'll look forward to the slightly cool temperatures coming up.
Absolutely. Stay cool today. And again, and enjoy the 70s and 80s next week. Good to chat with you as always.
Take care, Mike. Bye.
Bye now.
And we've come to the end of this Thursday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I almost said Friday because dare we groove into the weekend on a Thursday? Yes, we do. Actually, for a very practical reason. I have tomorrow off, so we've pushed our news buzz ahead, if you noticed today. Joining me now to end the program, Mark Simmet of IPR Studio One Tracks. Mark, do you think we can reel it out on a Thursday instead of a Friday?
Well, it's a little unusual, but sure.
Okay, let's groove into the weekend. And I see the first one in your lineup is some real mood-boosting music. Who do you have?
Yeah, it's Trombone Shorty, one of the leading lights in the New Orleans music scene these days. There's a lot happening in New Orleans, as there has, you know, been for, 100 years or more. The new album from Trombone Shorty is called Lifted and features some guests. The track we're going to hear includes contributions from the New Breed Brass Band, and it's called Everybody in the World.
Everybody in the World, Trombone Shorty there, otherwise known as Troy Andrews. Wonderful stuff, as I said, lifts your mood. And you talked about New Orleans being a center of music for over 100 years. This band that you've got next seems like it's been around for about 100 years, but not quite that. The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, huh?
Actually, they go back further than I thought. The band started in 1966. And Jeff Hanna was one of the co-founders of the band, and he is the sole remaining original member in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. They've had a long, illustrious career, no doubt. Their last studio album was in 2009, and they're back with a new studio album. And it's kind of surprising they haven't done this before. The record is called Dirt Does Dylan. And, of course, it's a collection of Bob Dylan covers. And, you know, I thought, okay, Bob Dylan covers, we've heard that. We continue to hear that a lot. Some great songs. Many people do these songs, and they do pretty much the songs you'd expect from Bob Dylan on this new album, which will be out next week, by the way. But actually, as I listened to it, despite the familiarity of the songs, they do such a great job of really getting inside the lyrics, if you will, and the music, that you kind of hear the songs in a new way. You hear them almost for the first time, which is very difficult to do with such familiar material. And they have special guests joining them, Steve Earle, Roseanne Cash, Jason Isbell, and The War and Treaty all contribute verses. It's just a great version of this timeless song.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam. And admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Come writers and critics.
Okay, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band with a new cover, The Times They Are A-Changing, from their new album, Dirt Does Dylan. We'll go out with this. Mark Simmet of IPR Studio One, thank you so much for grooving us into the weekend, so to speak, on a Thursday. Take care.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ben.
Support for IPR comes from The Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about The Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
Today's River to River, produced by Zachary Oren Smith. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Take care. See you again soon.
Come, senators, congressmen, please hear.